The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to today's edition of the Retirement and IRA Show. We are live broadcasting as we record this, so one of the advantages to broadcasting live over the internet when we record these is we can actually take callers. And I believe here shortly we're going to have a caller from a listener.
A caller from a listener?
A call from a listener.
There you go.
I'm trying to type some words and say other words at the same time, which clearly has overloaded my brain. So, so we're going to have a live person on the show, which is what we really enjoy because we can have an interaction. We can ask them questions. They can ask questions of us. We can really get into some things. And he has a slew of questions. So, here he is. We'll see if this actually works here. Dun-dun-dun-dun. Good afternoon. We're going to call you George.
Okay. Very good. Good afternoon, Chris.
Good. And Jim. Yeah, and Jim is here too. And I, Laura said you wanted to be called by another name to protect your innocence and/or privacy. But if you've listened to the show for a while, we don't like to give Jim too many different names to deal with because he even to this day, when I show up in the office, he'll refer to me by names other than my own. So, right.
So the mistake is if I knew your real name and your name you want to be called by, I'd mess it up. So we just call everyone George, and it's very easy for me. Yeah. Now, if I could only get women I date to just go by the name George, I'd be all set.
You could find some George. There's Georgette out there. Might like go by Georgie or George.
Yeah. So I limit my dating life to Georgies.
Some Georgettes and Georgians. Yeah.
Georgina. Yeah.
There's a few choices. So, George, thanks for calling in. We, like I said on the intro, we really like having live callers. And Laura did give us an idea of the questions. You're welcome to ask them in any order, and we'll do our best. Okay. And if it's something that we can't tackle, we'll certainly give you some guidance on where you could go. Or
we'll try to find it for another day.
We'll get back to you with the info. So what's on your mind today, George?
Well, I was thinking about trust and revocable trust. And the thing that was kind of worrying me is that things might change or, you know, I don't really want to get real involved in procedures and so forth. And a will would seem to be much easier in case, you know, you have, let's say, large hospital bills or something. I've heard of people just going bankrupt that, you know, had lots of money set aside and so forth. And I don't want to, like, disappoint people So I was thinking it might be easier just have a will and then just change it myself and, you know, whenever it needs to be adjusted. Mm-hmm. Also, mm-hmm. I was curious to know if a trust, a revocable trust, has to file taxes, because I'm not a tax guy. I'm not, you know, very skilled at it, and I try to keep everything as simple as possible. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of like the Jim of tax returns. Got so I just want it as easy as possible, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so I think both of those questions are kind of related as far as the complexity of dealing with a trust. The second part is easy with a revocable living trust. It's a pass-through for taxes, so there it doesn't really enhance your or increase the complexity of your taxes yearly. So,
is there something that has to be filed, though, like a form or something? You know,
not that I know of, but yeah. Chris and I are not estate planning attorneys, nor do we play one on TV. And
I'm not aware of one either. The biggest issue with paperwork is actually transferring the asset titles into the
exactly.
The
I've name never of the heard trust. Any attorneys ever say, "And you're going to have more complexity in your taxes," because again, a revocable living trust, which is the type of trust you're talking about, kind of passes everything through to your Social Security number. Your Social Security number is actually the tax identification number of the trust. It just passes right through to your Social Security number. So it works seamless. And because it's a revocable living trust, there's no creditor protection. There's no bankruptcy protection. All's what it does is make managing your assets a heck of a lot easier in life or at your incapacitation, which to me is the true benefit of revocable living trust. And if you live in a state that is a nightmare for probate, such as California, revocable living trusts are a mainstay. And if our attorney was on the show with us, and she's not here right now, Darcy Gerdes, she's actually a licensed estate planning attorney in the state of California, and she will tell you how much of a nightmare it is. Now, I'm not saying you're in California, but you have to look at your state and see if probate is a nightmare or not. And in California, it is. Why a revocable living trust is better than a will is a will has to be probated.
Which essentially the court gets involved, and anytime you do that, all kinds of crazy things can happen. Is the way to sum it up. Now he was concerned with what if my life changes between today when I set this thing up, and down the road if I want to change who gets what and this asset goes there versus here.
Yeah, you have to.
You'd
change
have to update
the trust.
Your will, which he's saying he could just do on his own. How much more difficult
now,
is it
again,
to change the
I'm
trust?
Not an estate planning attorney. Now, if Pete was here, you cannot just, Pete or Darcy was here, you cannot just change your will on your own. Your will is a legal document. It has to be witnessed, has to be signed and notarized by two independent witnesses that you are of sound mind. It's a legal document. You just can't pull out your pen, start redlining it, and say, "This is my new will." Now, there is a word for that, and I wish Pete was here. When you do write your own will, there is a word for it. But Pete has also warned us on this show before, Chris, they're not easily acceptable by the courts. They still have to be witnessed
and signed.
You said
you can't do that. You can do that, but then you essentially open it up to being contested, and all the reasons why you put the thing together is going to come back to haunt you, because they're going to be the people who are supposed to get your stuff afterwards are going to be fighting amongst each other trying to say, no, this wasn't the legitimate will.
But legally, to change a will, it's not just redlining it, initialing
it
and putting a net date, a new date. They're not going
to
honor that. It has to be witnessed that you are of sound mind, and what do they call it, sound mind and soul, or sound mind and something? So changing your will is not as direct as it sounds, George, and changing your trust is not going to be as direct as it sounds. However, either is fairly straightforward when done correctly. The whole point of a revocable living trust is the word revocable. It's not irrevocable. It can be changed. But what it allows, remember, people die, people become incapacitated, trusts do not. So if you became incapacitated and someone has to help you, the best is a revocable living trust, because your assets actually get retitled to the trust. Your house, your real estate holdings, your auto titles if you want, your brokerage accounts, not your retirement accounts. Any account that passes by right of law, such as an insurance policy, an annuity, a 401k, an IRA, a Roth IRA, any of those do not get titled to the revocable living trust. But all non-retirement assets get titled to the trust. The trust becomes the owner. But the owner, they use your Social Security number. Everything passes through. All the tax implications, all the income, all the expenses, all pass through to you, just like you own it now. But what happens is at your incapacitation, whoever your co-trustee is, or your it could be just you, there may not be co-trustees, but if you became incapacitated, your trust will have language naming another person to step in as trustee. There's no retitling issues. The trust owns it. The trustee is just a representative of the trust, and everything moves smoothly, especially when it comes to real estate. Try selling or try having an agent sell property for you, your home or a rental property or an investment property, through a power of attorney form.
Right. Which when is, you're in the hospital.
When you're in the hospital, because a will not allow that. A will is about dying, not living. So married to the will is going to be a POA. The power of attorney form is how your you're not dead yet, so how all your other assets are going to be handled because you are now incapacitated. It's going to be a nightmare to try to do anything with real estate with just a POA form. With a trust, it's not bad because the trustee steps in. The trust owns the real estate. There's nothing wrong with the trust. Just because you're incapacitated, the trust still owns it. And the document says, if I'm incapacitated, the new trustee is this person, and this person can step in, has to act as a fiduciary in your behalf, and start managing your property and your investments. So I'm not against wills. I'm not for them. I'm not against trusts. I'm not for them. In the right situation, they're good. But I don't think either one, I don't think one is easier than the other to edit quickly. You still need to, they're both legal documents, so you have to follow legal proceeding to change them.
One bit of flexibility before we move on that you would have is, say your story or your situation changes, you can move assets in and out of the trust. It's not a one-way door. So if there was something that was outside of it that was being controlled by the will language that you then changed and you wanted to put it in the trust 10 years from now, you could do that. Or vice versa, an asset that's in the trust and you're like, no, I don't want it to go where the trust is going to send it, and I don't want to rewrite my trust documents. I'll transfer it out and it'll be part of my will documents, part of my estate documents.
Correct.
So you do have some flexibility in that regard without doing a big rewrite of either document. So just keep that in mind.
Now, if I could mention that, when you have an IRA or any other type of financial organization that you've set up, you have to file stuff with the government. I mean, somewhere. Are you telling me that it's like a will and that there's no paperwork on this? On the revocable trust, how would the government even know you had one?
We never said there was no paperwork. There's definitely paperwork on a revocable living trust. Mm-hmm. There's paperwork on a will, and there's paperwork on a revocable living trust. You have to create the trust. The trust is a document. You're going to put in that trust, in the revocable living trust, who the trustees of the trust are, who the co-trustees are, if any, what you want to happen. The whole idea of a trust is protection and control. So who do you want to get your assets? If you're incapacitated, who's going to manage them? If you die, who's going to inherit them? All that is put into the trust, just like it would be put in with a will. You don't file the trust with the government, but you don't file a will with the government either. All that becomes an issue at your incapacitation or death.
Right. So it's legally prepared. And then it isn't until someone wants to act on, use the language of the trust for an action, that then the trust is revealed to possibly legal authorities to say, I have the right from this document to go and access his brokerage account on his behalf because I'm the trustee, that type of thing.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Maybe this might be a better way to look at what I was commenting on. When I go to my tax preparer, do I tell them, hey, look, I have a trust here. You better, you know, factor that into whatever else you're doing. Does it interact with anything else you're filing as far as tax returns go?
It's not going to affect your taxes, George, because, again, it's a pass-through. But it would be behoove you to tell your trustee. It's not going to increase your taxes. It's not going to decrease your taxes. The revocable living trust passes everything through to you because it uses your tax return. So excuse me, your Social Security number.
If you've got taxable gains or something that's going to affect your taxes, they're still going to be connected to your Social Security number, even though that account is inside the trust. That's what Jim is saying. So it's whether you held it in your own personal name or it's in the name of the trust, titled to the trust. It's still, when it comes tax time, those gains will have to be reported and treated the same as in either case. So it's just because you put it in the trust isn't going to hide it from anybody.
I see.
It's just legally in the name of the trust, but there's this kind of background connection to your Social Security number, and that's what makes it a pass-through. It's not so different than actually transferring the assets in an irrevocable manner to another entity, whether it's a trust or someone else, where you try to wash your hands of it and make it someone else's property. That's not what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I ask you another variation on this theme?
Sure.
I was thinking of also, like, if I put $10,000 in, let's say, an irrevocable trust for a niece or a nephew that's very young. You know, I'm talking like 6 or 7 or 8, you know, let's say under 10 years old. And it would be for like a 50-year period, but you would put like $10,000 into something like a S&P 500 with the dividends reinvested. And then she or he wouldn't be allowed to access it for like 50 years. And they still wouldn't be 60 years old yet. But whether it's that, in that case, you're going to have interest that you collected inside there. And would that be taxable? Or would it be better to buy something that you think might be a home run stock, like Alibaba, that you think might go up 10,000% or something? And then they wouldn't actually have any gains until they sold the stock. So there wouldn't have to be any reporting of dividends or anything like that.
Well, let's go ahead, you can say the one last and, so before I go on my tangent.
And then just to finish up the thought, so 10,000 might grow to a million or more over a 50-year period with compounding. Yeah, so that's what my thinking is. When I'm very old, I could call them up and say, hey, you got all this money in here. Did you know that? But Jim's going to set me straight.
Yeah, that's not going to work, George, for a variety of reasons. First of all, trusts just aren't some run-of-the-mill document. It's not like you can go out, buy one, and cost you $50, and you open it and you put money in it. It's going to cost you thousands to have a attorney create a trust, especially an irrevocable trust, because an irrevocable trust is a completed gift. It's going to have special rules attached to it. So it's probably not going to be worth your cost to create a trust to fund it with $10,000 to buy something. But let's just assume cost of the trust is immaterial to you and you want to move forward with that because you want to pass this asset on to your niece or nephew.
Yeah.
The second thing you're going to run into, and we don't give advice on individual stocks on this show. We're not stock jocks like we often say. But to think that you're going to buy a hot stock like Alibaba and your trust is going to hold it for 50 years and nothing is ever going to happen with that stock, that is ever going to require it to be sold for 50 years, that's not practical. However, if all what it was generating was unrealized capital gains, as long as the trust never sold anything, theoretically, there would be no tax issue. But you would have that in a trust or out of a trust, no tax issue. The reality is, over 50 years, there's going to be some sort of tax issues. Mm-hmm. And if you hold the money inside a trust, trusts have the most onerous.
Outrageous.
I like onerous. It was a bigger word.
Okay. We'll go with onerous.
It's onerous, not onerous?
I say onerous.
Whatever.
You can say onerous.
Tomato, tomato.
Yeah.
Has one of the most egregious. That's a better word. Egregious.
Offensive.
Offensive.
How about that?
That's good. Offensive tax rates of anything in the tax code. It pays the highest tax rate at just $12,500 of income, whereas it would take an individual almost $500,000 of income. So you don't use a trust for tax efficiency. It is the most tax burdensome way of holding an asset. People use a trust for protection and control, plain and simple. If you want to protect and control money, but I've never heard of opening up a trust and all the legal documents for a $10,000 donation into the trust or gift into the trust. Not to mention an irrevocable trust, not a revocable trust, an irrevocable trust will have to file annual tax returns. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be outrageously expensive because a trust tax return is not straightforward. You're not going to go to H&R Block with your trust. So you're going to have to hire probably a CPA or an enrolled agent and have also all that kind of cost associated with it. To me, if you want to restrict your niece and nephew from getting any kind of inheritance and keeping an asset for 50 years, it's going to be nearly impossible to do because when you put money in it, you're making an irrevocable gift. It's a completed gift. Once you put it in... a trust,
which you could do. I mean, there are ways.
You could keep them from getting it,
ways,
but you're not for $10,000.
It would be if you can be more, if you can be comfortable with the chance that they could make a bad decision and access it. You could just gift them money in the form of making Roth contributions on their behalf once they have their first little part-time job, with the understanding, I'm going to put this money in here. If you ever touch it, I will never put another dime in there or some other threat you might come up with. And then you're able to fund it really early in their lives. And not only at the end, well, hopefully they
but
have
But there's
something.
No way to protect it for 50
there's
years.
There's no protection, no. But there'd be no taxes on the thing at the end, assuming Roth rules don't change. And, I mean, that's if you can crack the door open to the lockdown protection of a trust that you would get, it eliminates a lot of the other downsides that Jim just mentioned.
I just don't think it's worth it for $10,000.
Not for a trust, no.
No.
Okay. Well, but the revocable would not file taxes, and I wouldn't have some of those issues if it was a revocable situation.
That's why so many people do it, even of modest means. Yeah.
Is there a possibility to have more than... one?
Yeah,
sure.
Can have as many as you want. Yeah, can have as many as you want. I don't know why you'd want more than one, but absolutely you can have as many as you want.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's interesting.
And the only way, again, if Darcy was on, she could add more because, again, Chris and I are not attorneys, but I can't see a pro or a con to having more than one, except for the cost would be a con. You're going to have to pay to create each trust.
The cost might just be kind of mental accounting, knowing that this is over here and I've got this in this other bucket.
Maybe
and I'm keeping them separate,
dealing with multiple trusts.
Yeah,
but
I agree.
A revocable living trust is just passed through right to you. It's revocable. It offers no protection and control from creditors, predators, bankruptcy, because you have complete and total access to the money.
You can take it out of
it. It is designed simply to help you if you ever became incapacitated, especially for real estate. I don't like power of attorney forms for directing real estate. As Pete said repeatedly on the show before he retired, he has been paid more to litigate real estate through a POA, trying to either get the POA to be honored, going against someone who filed under a POA. Whereas in a revocable living trust, the real estate is owned by the trust. Doesn't matter if you are incapacitated. The next trustee steps in, and the trust owns the asset, not you. You just happen to be the trust, but legally the trust owns the asset. So for handling real estate, the revocable living trust, in my very humble opinion, and again, I'm not an expert. I could be wrong. But handling real estate, I think, is a good thing for the revocable living trust.
Okay. Well, very good, gentlemen. I appreciate you commentary and on my thoughts.
Okay, perfect. Great. Yeah. Thanks a lot again for calling, and you have a nice afternoon.
Okay.
And George, what state are you in? I don't know if we ever got the state.
I don't think
Texas.
You said
it.
Texas. Okay.
Yeah.
Fine state of Texas. Okay. It's beautiful there this time of year, right? Cool, 70s.
Yeah. Cool, comfortable.
Oh, yeah. I got to get my sweater on.
Yeah. No humidity, a nice sea breeze from the ocean.
Yeah. You got to spray that sweat on you. That's not natural sweat. You got to spray it on you.
All righty. You enjoy Texas. It'll probably only be hot for a few more months. And we'll chat with you later.
We don't have forest fires like we do in California.
Oh, yeah. We're getting a lot in Colorado. True. And California's being nailed with them this year, too. The West is so damn dry. I'm getting fed up with it. Have you ever been to Kentucky, George, by any chance?
Yeah, sure.
You have?
Nice area.
See, it's nice.
Yeah. Well, there you go. There's a vote to
vote
support
of confidence
your,
for my
your
trip to Kentucky. My retirement to Kentucky.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
It's a perfectly fine state.
Thank you, George.
Okay. You have a good afternoon.
I hope you go there and make them all rich.
Okay. Thanks, George.
Right.
Have
we'll
a nice
see
day. Okay.
Bye bye. Bye, guys. We'll see. Bye.
Someday we're going to get a Kentucky caller, and I will be able to pick their brain about the fine state of Kentucky. Although I have been looking. It is freaking humid out there.
Oh, yeah.
I've been
that's
just
for sure.
Because I track Lexington.
You complain about the dryness here.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm torn
the other end
because
of the
it'll do
there
wonderful for my garden and for my girlish complexion.
And your skin.
My skin.
Yeah, you won't be all scaly and lizardy.
But I've just been watching because, you know, you really look at dew point, not necessarily humidity. And if the dew point is close to the temperature, it's oppressive. And especially when dew points start getting above 60 and 70. Oh, my Lord. It'll be like 85 outside and a dew point of 83.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, oh, my Lord, you can cut that with a fork.
You have to swim to work.
So I'm torn because gardener in Jim is thinking, oh, my Lord, the garden I could have out in Kentucky. The Jim who likes to hike and maybe do things outside without having to change his clothes every 20 minutes? He's thinking, we may want to rethink this.
Well, and that's why so many people in retirement have two homes. They have a summer home, comfortable, where they can still grow vegetables. And in the winter, you know, or vice versa, they escape Texas in the summer, right, to go someplace cooler. But then in the winter, they grow things when it's nice down there. You understand now why there's the snowbird kind of.
Yeah, but thing. If you look on a map, Kentucky and Colorado are probably equidistant. I mean, they're straight across. You can always draw a straight line.
Yeah, but all the states between Colorado and Kentucky, all that sweat from everyone that goes into the air piles up on Kentucky, and it's all just right there.
Just Kentucky. It piles up on just Kentucky.
Well, Kentucky and the surrounding states.
Yeah. Although I did talk to an iTunian on a Coffee and a Second Opinion call recently who lived for 15 years in Cincinnati, which is right on the northern Kentucky border.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only 70 miles north of Lexington, but it's like a whole other micro climate.
Mm-hmm.
Lexington gets 45 inches of rain a year and about 7 inches of snow, according to Wikipedia. Whereas Cincinnati gets about 20-something, about 22 or 28 inches of snow. Mm. And you're only 70 miles further north. Mm. So it has its own little micro climate happening. So I could move to far northern Kentucky and just make Cincinnati my go-to city instead of Lexington. But part of me also thinks temperate climate in the winter with 7 inches of snow, I could deal perhaps in my 60s with Lexington more than 22 inches of cold.
Yeah. Did they count the ice too?
Well, someone did share with me that Lexington is right on this like imaginary line where because it's too warm to snow and too cold to rain, you get massive ice storms.
Yeah.
So I haven't quite decided. But anyways, don't get me going on Kentucky.
Snakes
and stuff too. Well, there's snakes everywhere.
I don't know.
There's snakes here. I saw a rattler hiking a couple weeks ago in Boulder.
It's a good reason not
just
to hike.
Just lying right across the trail, just kind of minding his own business, but didn't really move. He looked at me, I looked at him, and I just kept walking.
Nice.
But had his little rattle go. He wasn't shaking it, but he had his little rattle out there. And anyways, there's going to be poisonous snakes everywhere. They
How about
do have
Costa Rica?
They do have ticks, though.
Yeah.
And you know what's odd is Kentucky, next to Tennessee, has some of the highest incidence of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And you know one of the states with the least incident of Rocky Mountain spotted fever?
Colorado, yeah.
Colorado, where the Rocky Mountains are.
It's crazy.
Why don't they call it Kentucky?
Kentucky
spotted
fever?
Spotted fever.
I don't know.
Fever. Or how about the Appalachian Mountain spotted fever? How did Rocky Mountain spotted fever ever get started when if you look, Google Rocky Mountain spotted
Sounds
fever.
Like discrimination.
There's hardly any in the West because we don't have a lot of ticks out here.
Right.
But Anyway, so Kentucky's still there, but
Costa Rica.
I don't want a foreign
stuff
country. I don't speak Spanish. I don't want to live in a country I wasn't growing up in. I like America. I don't want to be an expat, Pat, whatever you call it. So I don't know. I'm still 8 to 12 years away from retirement.
How about American Samoa? It's a long trip out there in the Pacific, but they use the dollar.
I want all four seasons in Kentucky. I like four seasons.
Okay.
And Lexington, in defense of Kentucky, it has no extreme weather. How did they put it? No period of extreme weather. They have all four seasons. They're delineated four seasons. So that's telling me the humidity isn't going to last much longer than August. At least the dew point being close to the temperature.
Mm. Okay. Keep trying to talk yourself into this.
If there's someone from Kentucky, call a show one day, will you? Let me know if I should move there or not. Okay. All right. Well, do we have time? Because I got a ton of email questions.
We've got time for one.
Just one?
Yeah. It's almost 5 o'clock here.
Oh, goodness. All right. Where's the one that you actually had to look something up on? What the hell did
I just
do
had to verify one? I got an email. It's a Social Security question, actually.
I found it.
Perfect.
Okay. So we will get to a Social Security question.
You might want to summarize it a little. It's a little long, but it's pretty straightforward.
I'm not going to be able to summarize this. Let me just read it since you're short on time. Hi, Jim, Chris, and Justin.
Mm-hmm. That's us.
That's us. Well, minus the Justin. I'm trying to figure out what the Social Security Survivor benefit will be when I turn 60 next year. I only found one letter from the Social Security Administration that was sent to my partner saying that his monthly payment will increase by 1.7% in 2013. Mm-hmm. I assume that the letter must be sent to him at the end of 2012 and before the beginning of 2013.
Correct.
He passed away in June of 2014. Mm. I would assume he would have received 1.5% increase in 2014, but I'm not sure if I read the table correctly.
Mm-hmm.
I want to find out whether his COLA adjustments for 2015, 16, 17, and even 2018 will be added to his monthly payment as if he were still alive, even though he passed away. Also, am I correct that
Let me stop there, because that's simple. We're broken into two pieces here.
Okay.
The answer is yes. All the COLAs, when you're going to receive spousal benefits or
survivor
benefits
in this case,
any COLAs that go on are accumulating, whether you're being paid at the time or not. In this case, he hasn't filed for survivor benefits yet because he can't until he reaches 60, which is just around the corner, according to the email. But in the background, those benefits, you are getting credit for those. So when they actually turn it on, they're going to look at all the COLAs that have occurred since the person, his partner, passed away because he was collecting at the time. So all those COLAs are going to apply.
Even if he wasn't collecting at the time, he would still get COLAs.
Correct. Even if he wasn't collecting at the time, any benefit would be growing in the background as
right.
you were waiting.
You don't
to file.
Lose the COLAs.
No,
the short answer, in 10 words or less, I'm very pithy. Chris goes on and on. 10 words or less, you will get the COLAs.
Correct. Yep.
Okay.
So good news there.
Good news there. Then he asked, am I correct that the amount I will receive at age 60 will be 71.5% of the full amount I would have been entitled to? Just so listeners know, before you answer this question, Chris, you are allowed to file at age 60 for survivor benefits, 62 for your own retirement benefits, unless you're disabled. That's a whole other story. Mm-hmm. But age 60 for survivor benefits.
Unless you're disabled and
then
he
can go
file
to 50.
As 50. Yeah.
Yes.
But generally 60 is the age for survivor benefits.
So will he receive less? The answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Is it 71.5% of what he could have received if he waited to his full retirement age?
For him, yes. And he is one of those falls into that range of years of birth where his full retirement age is different than his retirement full retirement age. So the retirement age for survivor benefits is slightly different than the retirement age for retirement benefits.
Can
I'm just
I
pointing
interrupt
out
and
he's
ask,
not asking about that, but he's just mentioning that.
Can I ask you a question tied
sure.
to that? Because our listeners might be getting a little confused. Mm-hmm. For some reason, folks, and I'm going to ask Chris why. Hopefully he knows the answer.
I don't.
Oh. Well, for some reason then, folks, and we don't know the answer, they have a weird full retirement age for survivor benefits for certain people born between certain years.
Right. Between 1955 and 1960-ish, right in that. There's like a 5 or 6 year period there. And he falls right in the middle of that. He was born in 1958.
And I have no idea why they do this. It's confusing as hell.
I haven't been able to discover the reasoning for
this. There's got
to
be a reason
someday
somewhere.
I will figure it out. This is one of those
and
questions.
And then we're going to blog on it and talk about it, for sure.
But for him, his full retirement age for survivor benefits is 66 and 4 months. His full retirement age for retirement benefits is 66 and 6 months. So it's not a huge difference, but it's a little
bit different. It's a 2-month
difference. 2-month difference. In his favor, survivor benefits are in your favor. So when there is a difference, the survivor benefit one is a little earlier than the retirement benefit one. That's what he's asking about. And if you do the math, it's a reduction of 0.4% per month on survivor benefits when they are claimed early prior to your full retirement age. So if you do the math from 66 and 4 months back to 60, so that'd be 6 years and 4 months early that he's going to, or 76 months that he's going to claim early, 71.5% is exactly what he would get. 71.5% of what he would get if he waited to 66 and 4 months.
And one thing to keep in mind, listener, just because you claim your survivor benefit early, and I'm assuming you're claiming your survivor benefit early because you determined that your personal benefit is greater than the survivor benefit, so you can claim your survivor benefit age 60, and assuming you're not working, so you're not going to lose any of this benefit due to the earnings test, because survivor benefits are not recalculated due to losses from the earnings test. They're lost forever. They don't recalculate survivor benefits, correct? You're looking at me with a doubt in your eyes.
No, I was thinking about something else while you were talking.
Okay. Mm-hmm. My suggestion, or what I just want to point out, I have no problem with him filing early if his personal retirement benefit is greater and he wants that to grow to age 70. There's no reason to wait, Chris. He can claim at age 60, grow his own personal retirement benefit to age 70, and then switch from survivor, even though he claimed it early at age 60, without any reduction of his personal retirement benefit at age 70. Right. So I like the idea of what he's trying to do. He's going to be paid for waiting as long as he's not working, because the earnings test could reduce those benefits. Mm-hmm. And that would be bad because they're not going to recalculate right. those benefits.
Now, we don't know that's the reason why. He's simply asking if he files at 60. We don't know the rest of the story.
Right. I don't know the rest of the story either, but I just think it would be a good thing.
That's a common approach where people will file for one benefit and then switch to another. And your own retirement benefit and the survivor benefit are separate enough pools that you can switch back and forth between them, or switch one to the other. You can't go bounce back and forth. But you can choose in what order and on what dates or ages you're going to claim those two independently. And you can have a strategy. You can strategize the system. I hate to say work the system, because that sounds like you're taking advantage of something you shouldn't. It's just a matter of approaching it logically and claiming one prior to the other when it will benefit you.
Exactly.
All under the rules. There's nothing wrong with this. It's not a loophole. It's not gaming the system or anything like that. It's just a matter of not making a mistake because you don't know the rules.
Right.
So you should look into this. If you are, this is one of those cases or one of those times when I like to point out, in particular, for those who have multiple benefits for which they are eligible. So you've got maybe a survivor benefit, maybe your own benefit, maybe a divorced spouse benefit, benefit from being married to someone else for 10 years, even though you're divorced now. If you've got these multiple things going on, make sure that you either do all the research it takes to fully understand so you don't make a mistake, which can be daunting because these rules are pretty complicated, or get with someone like ourselves or someone else competent who can kind of put all this out in front of you, do some number crunching, and show you for your particular situation what are the top 1, 2, or 3 ways of claiming, and then at least you can pick the one that you think is going to be best for you and not just go into it blindly. Because Social Security is not forgiving in that you can't go one direction and say, oh, I wish I didn't do that, I'm going to go this way instead. Once you start heading in a direction, it's very difficult to change. So once you start claiming something, many times you cannot easily or at all undo it and redo it again. So make sure that very first decision of claiming your Social Security, whether it's spousal, survivor, or your own, is well thought out and planned. Otherwise, you run the risk of leaving money on the table, and that's not good for anybody.
No.
Maybe good for the government. They get to keep more money. not good for us.
Before we wrap up on the show, before you start the music, I do want to again point out to our iTunian listeners, we do offer a coffee and a second opinion phone call. It's going to be a prime opportunity to give us a ring. If you ever have any questions on Social Security, we can help to see if our $75 Social Security analysis might be of benefit to you. We can also talk to you about your retirement planning, your tax planning, window, Roth conversion analysis. There's a lot we can help you with. We are live, breathing, practicing financial planners in the state of Colorado. So you'll be able to work with us throughout the United States. What makes our business model unique is our services are a la carte. You don't have to invest with us. You don't have to buy anything through us. You just pay us for our time. One other thing I do want to mention, too, if you could kill the music for a second.
Kill it.
No, you kill it, because
it's
usually
quiet in the back.
Because it makes me have to rush.
Oh, it goes on for a long time.
All right, well, if you want to.
No, yeah, fine, I killed it.
Never mind.
I killed it. No, it's over. No more music.
Did Ewan Jr. make his announcement last week or not?
Yes.
Okay, so people know that Junior's...
People know that Junior's moving on to a new chapter in his life. Junior, and that his name's Justin.
Justin, getting out of financial planning and retirement planning, totally going in a different direction.
Yeah, kind of a different opportunity, still in finance, but not specifically financial planning. And he clearly had some sort of calling that took him that direction, and...
Right.
I wish to
let all our listeners know, Justin and I are still very close friends. I was shocked. The whole staff was shocked.
He kind of came out. I talked to him a little bit about it. Just
came out of nowhere. I would have preferred, and he knows this. I'm not throwing him under the bus. I would have preferred more than a 2-week notice. Oh. But we wish him well. He's helped the firm, I think you will agree, tremendously over the past 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to keeping in touch with him. We are. For all the people who have worked, we've had several iTunians call today. He sent letters out to all clients, and a few have called today. Let me talk to Justin. I'm going to talk him out of it and things like that. But Justin is going to be working closely. We have an enrolled agent coming on board. I will be introducing her shortly, be bringing her on the podcast. Mm-hmm. She, enrolled agent, is a tax professional. So she will be taking over on a lot of the tax planning and projections. I'm looking forward to getting a new set of eyes in the sense. Enrolled agent is, in my opinion, one of the prestigious designations. It was the designation Justin was working on when he decided to get out of the field. He didn't have his EA designation. But I do have an EA colleague who is going to be stepping in and assisting with a lot of the tax planning projections we're doing. So I'm excited about that. Mm-hmm. I'm actually going to be interviewing another enrolled agent from the fine state of Kansas after this call. I'll be interviewing him today because we're still looking to permanently replace Justin's position. So if there is anyone out there, I know I have a lot of industry people who listen to our show. You would have to relocate to Colorado. That may or may not be a good thing. But if you are an industry professional with either an EA designation or a CFP designation, we'd be very interested in talking
to
you.
Or both. That'd be the bonanza.
That would be like the jackpot.
Yeah.
And we are looking to hire someone to replace Justin. I have been interviewing people, but we did have a CFP colleague of mine who has been working with Justin for several years step up and is going to be working in helping our planning clients still move forward. And again, we have the enrolled agent who is going to be filling in and giving us some info on taxes. So as a firm, we're not skipping a beat, but I do want to thank Justin. He couldn't be here today. His family's out visiting, so he couldn't come on the radio show today to say another goodbye. But he gave us 3.5 wonderful, wonderful years. He will be sorely missed. He is a good friend and still is a good friend and is a fine worker. And I think you share with me in wishing him all the best.
Absolutely.
And again,
I'll give you more than 2 weeks.
Give me more than 2 weeks.
When I leave.
You're not leaving. I'm going to put a bullet in your head. Or at least your knees so you can't walk out this door. You're not leaving until we learn how to do that recording.
Okay.
Seriously, if you want to leave, leave. Just don't leave until I know what you do with all. I couldn't even get my recording microphone on a computer today to work. That it's stuff okay. there, no. I won't let him. It was sad to see him go. You, I'm locking the door, shooting you in the knee, and you're stuck here until I learn this stuff. I'll probably go to jail
know,
over
at
that.
At least I know where I stand now.
But,
can I start the music now?
Well, I just, again, want to reiterate, if there's any colleague out there, I know a lot of people listen to our show. You know Chris and I take retirement planning serious, and so did Justin. We're all professionals. We all pride ourselves in our education. So if you are an industry professional who shares in that, please contact us. If you are a salesperson, don't even bother calling. I won't give you the time of day. It's not what we do here. We're not. I don't care how much sales you do, how much great sales you do. We're not a sales organization. We're a financial planning organization. We're looking for credentialed individuals who take retirement planning serious, either a CFP, an enrolled agent, a CPA, who understands financial planning. We'll even accept the RMA, is it? The one that Wade Fowle started, Retirement Management or RICIP or something. There is a, there's a designation, yeah. relatively
There's a couple
new.
Of other, CFP is kind of the most prestigious and most well accepted for credentialed financial planning experts. But there is a few others that would,
right.
you know.
The one, Wade Fowle belongs to an organization that started a designation for retirement planning.
Yeah.
I've looked at their course load. Yeah. God, I hate that word. it's not, that one trips me up more than anonymity.
Oh, wow.
I'm nailing it. But not curricular. Just say it. What is it?
The breadth of courses they take.
I like that. That's good.
The curriculum.
Whatever that word is. Yeah. I love the courses. It looked really good. So anyways, I'm not looking for a sales position, please. Don't call me if all you do is sales. But if you truly are a planner and want to be a financial planner and work in the best interests of clients, that's what we do here. Reach out to us. Justin is going to have big shoes to fill, and we're actively looking to fill them.
Nice.
That was it.
That was a good idea. I didn't think about putting it out over the podcast.
Yeah, you didn't think of that. See, I do.
Really
we have a lot of industry listeners. They reach out to me every now and then. Yeah. Maybe some would like to relocate to Northern Colorado.
It's a beautiful place to live.
Except in the summertime, it's hotter than heck.
It is not.
It is. Oh,
I was just
hate
in New
it.
York, and I've been to Texas, and it's nothing like that. It's very comfortable in the summertime here.
We don't have as nice a weather as Kentucky, but you can come to Colorado.
Okay, so that music means we're here at the end of another podcast. We'll be back with you next week. If you would like to contact us, jimhelps.com is probably the best way to go. jimhelps.com. All of our contact information is on there. You can get to know a little bit more about us. And contact us right through the website, or we have the old-fashioned telephone as well. You can get the phone number right there on the website.
Excellent.
So, we'll be back with you next week with a brand-new podcast, hopefully. So
we'll be here. You'll be here, maybe with a wounded knee, but you will be here.
Got it.
Because I don't know how to do that, and you can't leave because Justin just left.
Okay.
All right.
I'll stick around.
All righty.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.